Hey, it's Andrew. Just quickly before we start this episode, I want to tell you about one of my favorite podcasts, the Secure Ventures podcast. The host, Kyle McNulty, interviews cybersecurity founders about what they are building. I enjoy it because Kyle focuses on their technology, what it solves, why they build it, where it fits in the market. Also, listeners can understand the why of these startups. In some ways, it's a great complement to my own podcast where I focus on the go-to-market side, not the technology side. He's had some great guests on recently, for example, the CEO of Reality Defender, when they talked about the ins and outs of deepfake detection. He's had the co-founder and CEO of Ghost Security, and also the co-founder of Radical, Chris Peterson, who was incidentally a founder of Logrhythm, where they talk about the role of AI in the SOC. This is not a paid promotion. I just simply enjoy what Kyle is doing with his interviews and get a lot out of them. Check it out. It's the Secure Ventures podcast. Now on with this episode. In this episode, I talk with Head Kovitz, the CEO and co-founder of identity protection company Silverfort. Silverfort has been growing really well over the last few years and attracting some great talent. And for this interview, Head and I focused on three decisions that he and his co-founders made that shaped in a large way how Silverfort looks today. They were around the type of product they wanted to build, how they wanted to go to market, and what sort of company they would want to work at. And Head goes through the decisions and the upsides and downsides of each of them. Don't go away. Welcome to the Cybersecurity Revenue Growth Podcast, where we help cybersecurity companies grow sales faster. I'm your host, Andrew Monahan. Our guest today is Head Kovitz, CEO and co-founder at Silverfort. Head, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Head, the saying goes that it's in your moments of decision that your destiny is shaped. And no doubt there have been times in your life, in the life of Silverfort, that a decision that you've made shapes big things that happened afterwards. Sometimes good and sometimes not so good. So unintended consequences sometimes. So today what we're going to do, explore three of those decisions that you've made along the way. Why don't you take us back to the first one?
Sure. So this really goes back to when we really started the company, or even before that, when we just had the idea of what we want to do, which in our case was around identity security. Now, we knew that we want to build something in identity security because we knew it's a big problem that is only getting bigger. We knew that, you know, something that is not done right because there were so many attacks that were using stolen identities still. But still, we didn't know what the product will be. What are we going to build? What will make it different or attractive?
So, Head, let me interrupt because I want to get into the detail on this. So when you say we, who's we?
Me and my two co-founders, Yaron Kastner and Matan Fatal. We started this company together. We knew each other from before. And we knew that we wanted to do something, to start a company. We also knew that it should be an identity. We had an idea for a product, but it kept evolving. I think naturally, right? I think most founders don't end up building exactly the product that they started with because they listen to the market and they adjust, hopefully. But we were at that ideation phase where we were trying to figure out what to do. And I think that there was a lot that I took for granted there in our assumptions or the way we did it that I understand only today that it wasn't that obvious. And maybe there are other potential ways to do it. For example, it was very clear to us that we want to build something very different, like completely rethink the way that identity security is done and do it in a much better way. And that involved inventing new technology and figuring out a whole new approach, which to us sounded obvious. Like, why would you want to be a me too? Why would you want to do something that five other companies are already doing? And I think that was a point where, looking back, we didn't really understand the meaning of this decision. I think that I'm not saying that I would necessarily have chosen differently. I think that obviously I'm happy with where things are going. But I think that there was something there that was obvious to us that we have to build something new and completely different than anything else. That now, after a few years of me speaking to so many other entrepreneurs and watching their journeys and giving advice to some entrepreneurs that are only getting started, I understand now that it's really not an obvious decision, and there are pros and cons to it. So, you know, if you go build something that is not completely unique, but it is in a very hot new category where there are only, you know, 3-4 players and you're going to be the fifth one, and you know, you execute well, and you may not be the only vendor doing that, but you'll be one of a few companies that will all be successful, or the good ones at least will be successful. So it's not a condition to do something completely differently in order to succeed. If anything, I learned over time that some of these companies had quicker success. Okay, maybe the long-term potential maybe is not as big as what I believe ours is, just building something completely revolutionary. But I also didn't fully understand the benefits of doing that, you know, of going to something well-defined, very hot, that people understand, and there are a few companies to learn from and compete with. We went to invent, you know, a type of product, a category. Luckily for us, we were at least doing it in a, you know, to solve a known problem. We didn't educate anyone about the problem. I think that's always almost too difficult. We only needed to educate them about a new way of solving it, but that's still a longer path. And I think that we didn't fully acknowledge that. The result of that ended up being, you know, us building this for a few years before we really started going to market effectively.
So I would imagine the three of you are there and you're naturally thinking the right way to do it is the different way, right?
Yeah.
Are you kind of answering the question, well, what about this and what about that, and realizing that there isn't something that does this, there isn't something that does that, and then you're, well, I need to build this, and then we need to build that. You must see a long list of things that you're kind of realizing along the way. Holy crap, we actually need to build all of this ourselves because there's not something we can go get from somewhere else.
Yeah, and that was the exciting part for us, is building something completely different, overcoming all these barriers. You know, we met some other companies that told us, hey, this is impossible. You know, we tried to build it and it's impossible because of this and that. We get more excited. And I think that eventually it paid off because we were able to cross those barriers and build something that I think is amazing. But that took a long time, and it took a long time to get the first customers to understand it. It definitely took time to get investors to understand. And I think that it was so clear to me that this is the only way to do it. And I know now that it's not, that there are other ways with other, you know, advantages, disadvantages, that in many ways are quicker wins. I'm very happy now because I'm already like, this is a lot of it is behind me. A lot of these existential questions of, will it even work? Will people even understand it? Can I even raise money? It's behind me now. So it's easy to say, hey, that was a great decision. That was an obvious decision, but it wasn't. Like early on, you know, going back to that, before we crossed all these barriers, I think I understand today that it was very not trivial.
And you mentioned their investors. I mean, investors oftentimes, you know, they're looking for the short route to revenue, right? You know, in many ways, they're looking for ways to make things quicker. Were you under a bit of pressure? Were they asking you questions about the length of time it was taking?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a lot of people raised their seed round without having anything to show, right? But we raised our A round with barely anything to show, right? Our investors had to be pretty patient and believing in what we're building and believing in us as people, which I understand today is in the early stages probably the most important thing for investors. But they really needed to believe that we're going to solve this problem and we're going to build that very, very different thing before there was a lot of proof. At least not from a go-to-market perspective until relatively late. It also changed the mentality of us as leaders and us as a company, where a lot of other companies around us, I mean, think a few years back especially, they were just, you know, doing a lot of press and growing super fast and burning money and making a lot of noise. That was the mentality. And in that market, in that mentality, we were the opposite. We were, you know, under the radar, very responsible, growing very slowly, trying to really make sure we have product market fit. Now, you know what? Looking back, it saved us. It saved us from mistakes that some companies have done in the, you know, the 2021 market. But that wasn't intentional. It's one of these things that I can be thankful for today, that we were careful, we were responsible. But most of it was because of that mentality that stayed with us from the beginning of the mentality of building something very different and knowing that this will take a long time.
I imagine, though, in amongst the three of you, there must have been some moments where, you know, a year or two in, you're looking at each other going, God, this is taking longer than we thought, or God, I knew it was going to be difficult, but this is more difficult than I thought. How did you approach it when those moments came up?
Yeah, it's true. I think that, I think that one of the most important things for entrepreneurs in general is probably the the ability to convince yourself that that you are going to solve this, right? That you're going to overcome these challenges, because there's so many of them. And there's so many points in time where you feel like this is not happening, this is not going where it should. And you have to, you know, pull yourself together and really convince yourself, really yourself first and your partners, that we are going to cross this, that it will happen. And then only then you can really convince others if you really believe in that. Because people can see if you don't truly believe in that. And I think that we did truly believe in it. We truly believed from the beginning, and I obviously believe in it even more today, that what we're building will change the market and it will be just a better way of doing identity security. But that was like such a big thing to argue and to believe in early on, where there was no proof, that that yes, it was a little, not a little, it was I feel like I it's like blacked out for me, but it was hard. It was difficult to handle those times where it didn't look like it's going anywhere necessarily, at least not as fast as it should. And those were challenging times. Like, you really, really needed a lot of work to just get yourself to keep going and believe that you will cross those challenges. The good news is that once you've done, so if you chose that long path, I tell entrepreneurs that are only getting started now, if you chose that longer road and you're going to build something very different, it's going to take a long time. The good news is, once you cross it, you have something truly great that is hard to compete with. It's something that is really, really special. But I think I will be lying if I would say that it was just the right choice. It was easy, you know. It was definitely the right thing to do, because now it's easy to say when I'm past a lot of that hard time. Early on, I was looking around and all these other CEOs that are friends of mine that are building something so quickly and, you know, selling their companies for hundreds of millions of dollars after 2 years or 3 years. And I was like, you know, I'm not even in that direction. Now, as I, you know, fast forward a few years, I'm very happy with my choice, because I crossed those barriers and I have something amazing that is really going to be big. But that's an unfair way if I just present it as if this was necessarily a right decision because of how I feel now, right? It wasn't like, I know that it's not trivial that it even got to this point.
Do you think the nature of identity and the complexity of identity meant that you had to do something completely different new? That in some submarkets, maybe it just doesn't need that whole new approach?
It's a great question. And I remember early on thinking about, you know, what we're going to do. And there were many reasons why I wanted to go into identity, right? I think that, as I mentioned, obviously a lot of attacks are using stolen identities, regardless of all the solutions that are out there. And I also always believe that, you know, if people will eventually work from anywhere, now this was before COVID, but if they will eventually work from anywhere and use any device, then, you know, network security will become less effective, endpoint security will become less effective. And if people can really connect from anywhere using any device, then it's really their identity that is your last line of defense. I believed in all of that. But as I analyzed the pros and cons, I think that you have to, when you really want to compare honestly the different categories, you see that there are inner categories where this is the case, like it's a big existing category where you can really, really get a lot of, like, become a big player if you do it right. The challenge is usually, like, it's too crowded. There are so many players already, so many solutions already, and building something new is almost unlikely in those big categories. And then there are small categories that are only now emerging, where you can probably build something innovative, you know, easier. But it's not a huge market yet, not necessarily a huge budget yet. You need to create something as a category. We took the decision to go for a very well-established category and try to disrupt it, try to do it in a very different way, which I think is a very difficult challenge. Again, looking back, I don't think I fully understood it back then. But the good news is, if you can actually cross that, if you can actually do something truly innovative in that category that is a real better way of doing things, then you can build something that will eventually be larger than, you know, than innovating in a very new, small market, at least, you know, at least until it gets bigger. But these are the pros and cons. And I think, yes, identity, the fact that it's so complex, that there are so many solutions in there, it definitely make it one of those markets where it's almost too scary to come near it. I think for a lot of other startups, it was too scary to even touch it. Now, by the way, it's changing. I feel like identity is becoming hotter. There are more startups that have the courage to try to go after identity. It looked like an old player's game a few years back. But that's what I think entrepreneurs should look for, is where We're into something that is actually a big category, but it's lacking innovation. People have been doing it the same way for a very long time, and maybe you can do it differently.
Yeah, I cast my mind back to when Palo Alto came in the market for firewalls. I mean, firewalls, whoever wanted to go work for a firewall company back in the early 2000s, right? It's like there's Checkpoint, there's Cisco, and not many others. And its growth is like 4% per year or something like that. But look what they did, right? They approached it very differently and really disrupted that whole market.
Very ambitious, but the reward is also bigger if you can do it.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to your second decision, Head.
Okay. So the next thing, you know, once we really, you know, so we went for it and we built something and eventually we really got something working and finally it was time to start going to market. Now, of course, the first few customers you have to find, and we can have a whole conversation about how you find your first customers, right? It's very hard to find those people that believe in you, probably believe in you more than even, you know, necessarily the product, but you really find someone who has that entrepreneurial mindset and they can really be that early adopter. But then you get to a point where you want to start, you know, scaling. It's not really scaling because it's pretty early, but you want to start getting a few more customers and not just going door to door. And there are different approaches to how to do it. And what we did pretty early, which I think was an important decision in the long run, was to invest a lot in partnerships and channel, which is not trivial when you are early on. I think that I also got advice from different people not to do it so early. No, just to be clear, it wasn't that early. It's not like I was trying to get my second customer to a channel partner, okay? It wasn't like that. But it was at the point where I think most startups are still mostly going door to door, using their connections, using advisors, using their investors. And it was clear to me that I want to build something that is actually scalable. I think that, by the way, is part of that mentality we just talked about of when you build something that is like a relatively long journey. One of the benefits is you get used to thinking relatively long term. You don't just build something in order to, you know, sell it 2 years later. I mean, the company, so you invest in things that maybe don't have an ROI that is very, very short term. And one of those things is channel partnerships, because I think everyone who built a go-to-market that is really focused on channels has seen that it takes time to get the return. You start by feeding them a lot and enabling them, and you don't really get much in return.
Hey, are you talking about traditional security reselling channel or some other type of partners?
In the beginning, yes, and in a minute I'll also mention a few others that I think are very interesting that we built over time. But initially, yes, it was the VARs and the distributors in certain regions where we didn't have people on the ground. And I think that the challenging part in this kind of decision is you don't get returns, at least early, right? You have a deal that you found, you qualified, you won, and you just feed it to a channel partner, and there's nothing coming back in return. And that took a lot of conviction in that strategy. Doing that again and again, even though you're getting less, you know, you're losing some margin there, and believing that, yeah, maybe it will take time. So it's not a disappointment that it's not happening right away, but over time it will be just a better way of scaling the business. Investing in it early is very difficult, especially because investors want to see more ARR. So if you're giving up on some of that ARR early on, it's a lot. Like, it means a lot. Every dollar is painful to give up on. If you know that it will serve you in 2 years from now, who cares what will happen in 2 years, right? It's so far. I just want that extra dollar right now.
And to be clear, I mean, in those circumstances, you know, you're paying your own team. And you're also giving margin, usually quite healthy margin, to the reseller, because you want to incent them to give you at some point something back, right? It's to get into something back is the hard thing, is what you're saying. You know it's not going to come immediately. It's going to take a few months or longer.
I think that's true for partnerships in general, because I think that over time, when this actually started to pay off, and it did. So just to be clear, you know, over time, partners became a huge source of pipeline for us and a huge force multiplier for us. We do the majority of our business through channel partners, and we get a lot of business from them that they source. But that took time, you know. So just like that other decision, it's easy to sit on the other end of that. I mean, not the end, but somewhere farther along that journey and say, hey, that was an obvious decision. It wasn't. And I think that with partnerships in general, there's a point there where it's very easy to give up. I think that's true for a lot of partnerships where you invest a little, and you don't get much in return. And I think the instinct of many people, especially startup CEOs who want to get really quick results, is let's give up and let's do something different, right? You always switch, you change, you try this, you try that, because that's what they teach you to do when you build product, and you need to be very agile. And I think that the thing that I had to learn is when you build that partnership, you need to fight your instinct to give up. And actually, if it's not working, sometimes you need to lean in more, and you need to do more and figure out, like, what do I need to do in order for this to really, really start going?
What did you learn about the type of partner, though? Because not all of them would be great partners for you that early.
That's a great question. I think that what I learned is that some partners really know how to work with smaller startups and like more emerging technology. And a lot of times they are not the biggest partners. They are the more local, regional, boutique partners that can actually have the attention to give to a startup, because they want to be, they're not the biggest, right? So they have to be the most innovative. They have to be the ones that bring new technologies. Because if you're the biggest player, you don't. You can just sell the big vendors and everybody comes to you. Those small ones, they have something to prove, which is kind of similar to a startup. They need to have a reason for those customers to work with them, so they want to bring new technologies. And I also learned that the key is to really get the technical people there, the SEs, convinced, because they are really the ones that if they get excited, even one person, you know, I need one person in this one reseller, one SE to get excited, because they will get you into two accounts. They just want to solve those problems for those customers, and they really understand your technology, which sometimes the reps don't. And they are the ones who start driving it. And then the reps, when the reps smell money, then they all come, and then they all want to work with you. But they're not going to jump on you right away, because there's no money coming from you in the beginning. The SEs might, and you need to really invest in them and enable them and get them excited in your technology. And sometimes one person who really gets it is enough. That's one thing I learned. The other, as I said, is a lot of it is really, you really need to build a relationship. It sounds obvious, but sometimes it's really that. It's both sides really need to believe in that partnership and want to promote it. And a lot of times it's just a personal connection. Not necessarily mine, but like the sales reps or whoever is managing that partnership need to really have a relationship and need to go out there, need to meet them, need to go to the office, need to host a lunch and learn with a few of their clients, needs to be there, you know, needs to be in the top of mind. That's the thing that you can do as a startup. You're not the biggest, you don't have a lot of revenues, but you can actually be there. You can spend time with them and invest in them, especially with those smaller ones that maybe not all the big vendors are. And then, as I mentioned, you need to sometimes lean in and really not pull back, which is your instinct, but actually figure out what more can you do. And another example of that is over time, we started building more types of go-to-market initiatives and partnerships. For example, we found cyber insurance to be a really good strategy. So, you know, cyber insurance tells customers they need to buy certain products if they want to be insurable. They want to be able to get insurance, and it's getting more and more strict every year. And we found that if we can tie our product to how can we make those companies insurable, we can actually build partnerships with the insurance brokers and carriers. That was another one where, you know, it's an ambitious target to really get to a point where you work with these guys, but we leaned in on it. We said, okay, so it's not working, so we're not going to give up on it. The opposite. We're going to figure out what do we need to do. So we have two full-time people running this strategy, one in EMEA, one in the US, that are just spending time with these insurance partners, figuring out the program, the model, going, doing road shows with the brokers, sharing success stories from the customers who actually did it successfully. And now it's becoming a big source of pipeline. We're getting tens of deals every quarter that just come from this source. And again, it took time. Again, it took not giving up where there was no result, but actually leaning in. Now, you do need to, obviously, you can't lean in on everything. So you need to have some understanding of where are you going to focus and which partnerships are, you know, do have potential. But that's where, you know, in all these cases, and there are a few others, right? We have a great partnership with Microsoft and other technology partners. That was a similar experience where a lot of startups just, you know, tried and gave up. And hey, we're not really getting much from them. They're not really getting us deals. And we just leaned in and figured it out until we really got to a point where we're getting from these technology alliances, including, you know, Microsoft, tens of deals because we really spend the time and figured it out. I think you really need to believe in partnerships as the way to grow, because you can't invest in everything, right? You need to figure out what is your strategy. But I believe in that, and I'm glad that we started it early on, because that's why I can sit here today and say it actually works, right? If I would start it today, I would only get the results later on. So I'm actually glad we started early.
Yeah, if you're getting that number of leads through, opportunities through from partners, then clearly it's working. So And as you say, you know, you don't build a partnership in a couple of months. It takes a while for it to really embed, and trust builds up and relationships build up and suddenly things start flowing. So I really like how that pulled through for you. Head, before we wrap this up, let's get to know a little bit more about you. I've got a list of questions here. Believe it or not, I have 35 questions. The good news is I'm not going to ask you 35 questions. I'm going to ask you to pick three numbers between 1 and 35, and I'll read out the corresponding question.
Okay. 2, 9, and 21.
All right. Number 2 is iOS or Android?
Android.
Always Android?
Always. You got to stick, you know, if you pick one, you need to stay with it because switching is so painful. Yeah, I like my Android.
It is painful to switch. I can't imagine. So I'm an iOS guy. I can't imagine having to go through the probably days, if not weeks of work to try and, you know, switch over to something else.
Yeah, yeah. My wife has iOS, and if I need to use it for some reason, it's like, I think it's like, looks so unnatural, but I'm sure it's the opposite for iOS users.
I'm sure it is. All right. Number 9. What's the first hour of your day look like?
I have one of my kids wakes me up because I have small kids. I have a 1.5-year-old and a 4-year-old. So they wake me up, and then I'm like, I need to jump right into the, I don't even have a minute to understand what's going on. I need to immediately, you know, take care of them, get them to school and then start my day. But the good thing about it is I actually wake up. I had a problem waking up years ago. Now it's not an issue. Like I'm up.
Yeah, I think it is funny. I was reading something this morning, actually, from some guy who's clearly didn't have kids, who said, oh, my first hour of my day is I get up and I, first of all, I meditate, and then I don't know, do this and I do that. And I
must be nice.
Think about my day. And I was like, yeah, clearly you don't have kids.
Exactly. But again, I used to be like, I'm not a morning person. I used to barely get up from bed. Now, the good thing is I walk till, you know, I can walk till late hours, and I'm very, it's really easy for me, like in the nighttime. But now, because of my kids, I actually wake up and get effective pretty quickly, which is actually good.
All right. What was the last number you picked?
21.
21. Would you prefer a good book or a good movie?
That's a good question. I think that I would prefer a good book, but it obviously takes a much longer time, and I read so much during the day in my work. I sometimes enjoy a good movie better. But when I do have time to read, I do really, really like a good book.
And you prefer fact or fiction for?
Fiction, usually.
Yeah.
I mean, I watch movies or read books in order to disconnect a little bit from like the pressure of the day-to-day life, which for a CEO is a lot, right? So I want it to be very different from reality.
Let's move on to the third one.
Sure. So the third one is a little different. It's not really about the go-to-market strategy. It's something that I think a lot of people talk about. But I still want to talk about it because I feel like we've done a lot to really, really invest in that aspect. And that is our decision to really prioritize culture and team. I know it's a very, you know, common thing to say, and especially in startups, right? Investing in culture, investing in people, it's kind of like you almost have to say it if you're a startup. But I think that it also goes back to my decision to even start a company. In many ways, was not even about wanting to build a product in identity. I mean, that came when we wanted to figure out, like, what are we going to do? What product will it be? And you may be surprised, but it didn't even come from my wanting to get rich. Like, that wasn't the motivation. I think that a lot of the motivation there was really building the kind of company that I would have liked to work for. I think a lot of the motivation to even start Silverfold was wanting to create a workplace that where people will be treated the way I thought they should, where I actually control that, and I can create that environment. Which is why, you know, along the way, that was always a key thing for me to make sure that they do properly. You know, one is because, again, that was a lot of my motivation and my passion is really there. And second is because I actually believe that that's a key element to making companies successful. I think that in general, the advantage of a startup company versus a very large company is the fact that somehow a few, you know, small number of people are actually able to do above and beyond the numbers, right? The somehow do these amazing things and go above and beyond and be creative and do incredible things. And I think that has everything to do with how much they care about that company, right? And about their success. And people can say, hey, that's because, you know, they want to make money and they want to move their career. That may be true, but I think that most people day to day, a lot of what they do and how much effort they make is really for people. I mean, they can tell themselves a lot of it is for money or for whatever, but a lot of it is really the people around them.
Ahead, so you're right. I mean, this is something that you say is almost, you know, number 15 on the checklist of things as a startup is tell everyone that you're a, you know, people first company or some version of that. So let's get to specifics then. What have you done specifically that to really drive that?
Sure. So I think that what we've done throughout, you know, the history of this company, you know, whether we were small or now, is to really, really make sure that employees feel valued and work as one team. And that is, again, a very generic thing to say, but what it really means to us is we try to make sure that the whole company works as one team and not as different departments that are almost enemies, which I think is the case in some companies because they have different interests and they're trying to achieve different goals. But really make sure that the company works as one team that is trying to win the goal together, in the sense that, you know, we really try to not argue over whose fault it is when things go wrong, right? I couldn't care less about like whose fault it is that we lost this deal or we couldn't deliver this product feature. It's more like, how do we improve as a team? How can people really help each other, even if it's outside of their job? So, you know, if you need help from that other person, and even though it's your responsibility, you know, do I really have the kind of people that will come and help without, you know, without questions? Just because, again, that's the startup thing, right? We are all one team trying to win together. It's also about when people are struggling, and we all know, like, sometimes your employees are in a bad place with, you know, the family or their health or anything else that is challenging for them. It's really the place where I think it's most important to invest in them and help them, because that's the point in time where they realize that you actually care about them as people and not just the work, right? And I think that if you do a lot of these things and more, right, there's transparency and there's, you know, really making sure that we worry about career paths for people and how they progress and investing in them in many different ways. If you do a lot of these different things that we can talk a lot about, I think you get to a point where people really feel like it's their company and they feel like this is their team and it's like a place where people care about them. And that's the only way where they are going to care about the company. Because again, they can make their salary probably, you know, even if they don't go above and beyond, but I need them to go above and beyond. I don't need them to just do the minimum to get paid. They need to do amazing things, right? They need to do creative things. And I think they do that when they care about the company and when they care about the people around them. I think a lot of people that leave companies leave because of, I mean, they say they leave for better salary or whatever, but really they leave because of people, because their manager or something usually is the real reason. And we got to a point where we have almost no employee attrition. We have in the whole company, we have more than 250 employees today. We have between 0 to 2 people leaving voluntarily every year. So less than 1% leaving, deciding to leave the company. Not that I think this will stay true forever, right? Obviously, we're getting big. But I think that it's something that to me is very, very important, because not only it means that I can retain my people, the talented one, and make sure they're doing a good job, which I think is critical, it also means that people are here because they like it here, they believe in the company, they appreciate, you know, the way we care about them. They actually work together in a team. Now I have to say, this is easy to say a lot of these things, you know, transparency and caring about employees and so on. It's investing a lot of time, and that is, I think, what makes the difference. I actually spend a lot of my time on that, because I kind of feel like when you have a good product and you have a good market, the most important thing for the CEO to really do is make sure you have the best people and that they work well together.
I was going to ask, I mean, I think it also means that you must be hiring well, right? You must have focused in or dialed in what it takes to hire the right sort of person who isn't going to naturally, you know, attrition from you, right? I wonder if you get any learnings from trying to pick the right people.
It's true. I think that also has cost to it, which is time and attention. For example, I still interview almost every person that comes to the company. I'm not the one making the final decision. A lot of times it will be the manager, but I also interview them because not because I know better than the manager how to do marketing or sales or DevOps, but because I feel like I bring the element of what is that culture? What is that thing that I need people that come here to have in order to really be team players, not just say that they are, but truly want to work in an environment where people help each other and are not looking to point fingers, but are really trying to win as a team. And we had a lot of cases where you say hire well, but part of it is also not hire sometimes, even though it's a very talented person that is very high performer. And you talk to them and you feel like that's not the personality. And it means that we may have to not hire them, even though they look excellent professionally, because of it. And sometimes it's hard for the managers to understand that. But I think that they do, because over time, I think they have also seen the value of this approach. And I think that's crucial because I can sit here and, you know, go on podcasts and say, hey, I believe in all these things and culture and so on. It's almost meaningless at our size because it's really the team leaders that really affect what people feel, right? So I can say all these things, but I really need to have managers. And in that aspect, the lowest managers are the ones who matter most, that they are the ones who actually impact, like how people here feel. Are they feel valued? Do people care about them? It's not me. I can speak to the company, you know, here and there, and I obviously intervene in special cases, but I really need the managers to get it. I do calls sometimes with the whole management team, including the team leaders, and explain to them a lot of things in the kind of things we talk about here, obviously on a deeper level of like how to handle certain conflicts of responsibilities and what to do if someone is becoming very passive aggressive, you know, with other team members. Like a lot of things where you say, why is the CEO even dealing with that? Why is that not just the HR? But I do that because I think that's at least as important, sometimes even more than the product or the sales organization, right? It's like the fact that that whole machine is working as one, is not as just different pieces who are fighting with each other and slowing down the whole company.
And if, you know, I was just thinking through what we've talked about on this interview so far. And I think one of the words that comes to my mind to summarize this up for everyone is the word conviction. So you and your co-founders had the conviction to build the right thing that was needed, not just the easy thing that might have got by. You had conviction to, you know, when it took a long time to get there, you had the conviction to follow it through. Even when you probably had other people telling you there must be a faster way, you had the conviction of building the partnerships that you really needed over a long period of time, as opposed to thinking after 2 or 3 months, this isn't really working that well, let's go try something else. And then you had the conviction to really follow through on the people side and make sure you hire the right people and really retain the right people. So that's my big takeaway from this conversation in terms of one word to wrap it up for me. I'm sure the listeners will have something completely different. If they want to get hold of you, Ed, and continue the conversation or get in touch and ask you some questions, what's the best way to do that?
So first of all, people can reach out to me directly, right? Either via LinkedIn, Ed Kovetz, or even my email. It's head@silverfold.com. I'm happy to, you know, to talk with people. Again, I talk to entrepreneurs a lot and trying to help because I got that from like when I started and also until today, right? From entrepreneurs of larger companies that were helping me. And I'm always very happy to, you know, help anyone else where I can. I think that's our strength as an industry, that people really help each other succeed and we're not trying to fail each other, but we really give each other advice. I think that as entrepreneurs, you really, really need that because it's such a lonely role, especially CEO, such a lonely role. You need other people who are going through this or have gone through this and talk to them about it, even just to not feel so alone. So people are welcome to do that. And you know, if they want to get, you know, to talk deeper about any of these things, I'm happy to do that. And I agree with you. I think conviction is the key here, but I think that's a general thing for entrepreneurs in general and CEOs. That's the thing I mentioned earlier where I think that the biggest test is can you really, you know, get up after something brought you down, afterwards, like something didn't work out or something looks like it's not going to happen. And can you pull yourself together and be that person that gets back to a productive mode and be optimistic, right? Realistic, but optimistic and try to really get that thing resolved and not just say, hey, it's not working. That's not going to take you anywhere. And that conviction is key, but obviously you need to, you can't do everything. You can't have conviction about every possible strategy. You need to choose a few. And that's the area where talking to other people who have done it is probably the most important thing that I try to do. Just whenever I need to make a decision about, you know, a strategy, like what am I going to do? I talk with at least a few people who've done it. I don't try to fall in love with my own decisions. And I hope that I never will like get to a point where I think that I just know how to make all those decisions. I think that that's also the thing about being a CEO of a company. Like every year is like a whole new task that you have, you know, nothing about. It's like a whole different scale. It's different decisions. So it's a constant feeling of, I don't know enough. I really need to talk to a lot of people in order to figure out what I need to do. properly. And I think that's something you must never lose. Otherwise, you start to, you know, think that you know best and make mistakes.
Well, clearly your strategy of talking to others and getting their input and all the rest of it is working well. You know, Silverfort's been on a tear for the last few years, just looking at the growth numbers of at least employees and LinkedIn and some of the things you share with me. It sounds like you're on an incredible path. So congrats on that, and I encourage anyone who wants to get in touch, please get in touch with Hub.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time. It would mean a lot to me and to the continued growth of the show if you'd help get the word out. So how do you do that easily? There are two ways. Firstly, just simply send a link to a friend. Send a link to the show, to this episode. You can email it, text it, Slack it, whatever works for you and is easy for you. The second way is to leave a super quick rating. And sometimes that can seem complicated, so I've made it as easy for you as I can. You simply have to go to ratethispodcast.com/cyber. That's ratethispodcast.com/cyber, and explains exactly how to do it. Either of these ways will take you less than 30 seconds to do, and it will mean the world to me. So thank you.